tere varare. Gopi janavala bha kere varadhari. Yashoda nandana praja janaranjana. Yashoda nandana praja janaranjana. Yamuna tira vanachari. Yamuna tira vanachari. Paramahamsa Parigraha Kacharya, bestowed Tadasata Sri Srimad's divine grace, Isi Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada ki, Anantakoti Vaishnavrinda ki, Srimad Bhagavatam ki, all glories to the Asana devotees, all glories to Sri Sri Guru and Govardhan. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Jnana Timirandasya Jnananjana Shalakaya Chakshurun Militam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Shri Chaitanya Manobhishtam Stapitam Yena Bhutale Svayam rupa kadamayam nadati svaparantikam vancha kalpaturubhyascha kripasindubhyevacha patitanam pavanebhyo vaishnavebhyo namo namaha. Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhar Shivasadi Gaura Bhaktavinda. Hare Krishna 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 Hare Hare, Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare. Reading from the fifth canto, chapter 20, titled The Structure of the Universe. And we are on text 42. It's a prose verse, so we'll just go directly to the translation. Translation, text 42. My dear King, outside Loka Loka Mountain is the tract of land known as Aloka Varsha, which extends for the same breadth as the area within the mountain. In other words, 125 million yojanas, or 1 billion miles. Beyond Aloka Varsha is the destination of those who aspire for liberation from the material world. It is beyond the jurisdiction of the material modes of nature, and therefore it is completely pure. Lord Krishna took Arjuna through this place to bring back the sons of the Brahmana. Text 43. The sun is situated vertically in the middle of the universe, in the area between Bhurloka and Bhuvarloka, which is called Antariksha, outer space. This distance between the sun and the circumference of the universe is 25 koti yojanas, or 2 billion miles. Purport, the word koti means 10 million, and a yojana is 8 miles. The diameter of the universe is 50 koti yojanas, or 4 billion miles. Therefore, since the sun is in the middle of the universe, the distance between the sun and the edge of the universe is calculated to be 25 koti yojanas, or 2 billion miles. So we're progressively talking about regions of the universe that are further and further away from us. So Now we're talking about tracts of land, a tract of land called Alokavarsha. Aloka is outside Lokaloka Mountain, which is very far away from us. And this is the region of the universe where there's no inhabited beings. It's completely dark and no living entities are there. So the pastime that's mentioned in this verse is how Krishna and Arjuna, they went past all the different oceans and islands of the universe, and they penetrated the cover of the universe, and they went to go see Mahavishnu. So the pastime here is that when Krishna was on the planet, there was no such thing as newborn infants or children dying prematurely. That was unheard of. That just didn't happen at the time when Krishna was on the planet. But when there was this one incident where this one Brahmin and his wife, they had a child, and the child died immediately when it was born. So the Brahmana naturally became a little disturbed by this fact, because it wasn't happening, and all of a sudden it happened to him. So he went to go to approach the king, King Ugrasena at the time, and he started to blame the king for the death of his own child, saying, "What kind of king are you? You're meant to protect all the citizens, and here, look, my child just died when he was born. This isn't right." So the king couldn't do anything about it. He didn't know how to solve this problem. So Brahmana and his wife, they tried to have more kids. And then every time they had a kid, the kid died right when it was born. So when the Brahmana's wife was having the ninth child, he died immediately, and then the Brahmana was lamenting. And it turned out Arjuna was overhearing this lamentation by this Brahmana. And Arjuna started to not think so highly of the king, because, you know, it's supposed to be the duty of the king to protect the citizens. And Arjuna, being a qualified Kshatriya, he thought, well, you know, king should be able to do this. So he told the Brahmana that, okay, if the king can't do it, I will protect your son, and I promise. And if I cannot protect your children or bring back your children, then I will enter into fire. I will give up my body. So Arjuna was quite serious, but the Brahmana didn't take him so seriously because, Krishna was on the planet, Balaram was there, Pradyumna, Aniruddha, so many great kings and personalities. None of them could help the Brahmana with his children dying. So the Brahmana said, "Well, what makes you think that you can do it?" And Arjuna said, "I'm not one of them. I'm not Krishna. I'm not Balaram. I am Arjuna. I'm wielder of the Gandiva bow, and even if I have to battle death personified, I will bring back your children." He was that confident. So when the Brahmana and his wife were going to have another child, Arjuna was there. He was ready to do whatever necessary to prevent the child from dying. So he surrounded the house where the child was being born with all these arrows, like a celestial force field, so that nothing can come in and, make any disruption. But even with all of his power and this force field that he constructed, as soon as the child was born, it vanished. So Arjuna wasn't able to protect the child. So Arjuna was still very determined. So then he used his mantras, his powers, and he started traveling all over the universe. Upper planetary system, lower planetary system, the Yamaraj, the abode of death, and looked everywhere for this child, just so that he can bring it back, so he can be a man of his word. Because for a Kshatriya, being, not abiding by your word is kind of worse than death. Like, if you say you're going to do something, you will do it. Otherwise, you will die. So he looked everywhere. He couldn't find the children. So, being a man of his word, Arjuna said, "All right, I got to enter into fire now. I said I would do it, and I didn't, so I'll enter into fire." And just as Arjuna was going to enter into the fire, Krishna stopped him. Said, "Don't do this, Arjuna. I will take you to where the Brahmana's son is." So Krishna and Arjuna, they got on Krishna's chariot and they started driving west. And they traveled all, you know, all the way across all the oceans and islands of the universe, and they came all the way to this region of Alokavarsha, where there's, it's just pitch black, it's total darkness. It's described that the sun is on one side of this huge mountain called Lokaloka Mountain, and then on the other side is just total darkness, and this is Alokavarsha. So when Krishna and Arjuna got to this place in the universe where it was totally dark, Krishna's horses, they pretended to be bewildered, like they pretended to be lost, or they didn't know where to go. Of course, these Krishna's horses, they descended right from Vaikuntha, so they don't get lost. But they were pretending to get lost just to kind of enhance the drama of the situation. So they didn't know where they were going, and then Arjuna or Krishna took out his chakra and used it to light the way, so that the horses can go through this region of Alokavarsha. And it was described that this chakra is thousands of times more brilliant than the sun. So the horses were then easily able to just follow the chakra all the way to the edge of the universe. And then they penetrated through the coverings of the universe, and then they went through this area, and then they reached the Brahmajyoti, this area of like endless light. When Arjuna got to this, when they got to this area, it was really intense for Arjuna to handle. I mean, I would imagine it would be pretty intense getting to this point, but when he got to this point, it became a little overwhelming. He had to shut his eyes because it was so, the effulgence from the Brahmajyoti was so bright that he had to close his eyes. And Krishna said that this Brahmajyoti that we're in, this is the destination of the foremost yogis and ascetics, and this is like the destination of Sankhya. This is where all the those personalities go who achieve like Brahman realization or who want to merge into the Brahmajyoti. This is the destination for those souls. So anyway, they eventually go see Mahavishnu, who is lying down in the Viraj River. And there's this big, you know, it's a very big river with enormous waves, and there's this big palace in this river. So Krishna and Arjuna went to go see Mahavishnu, who resided in this palace. And Mahavishnu was reclining on Anantashesh. And when Krishna and Arjuna came before Mahavishnu, they offered their obeisances, and Mahavishnu spoke, and he said, "Oh, I just wanted to see you. I took the Brahmana's son, and the only reason was because I just wanted to see you. Because I knew that Krishna would take you here, so I just wanted to see my expansions of Naranarayana. So, anyway, you can go back to Earth now." That's it. So anyway, that's the pastime that's referred to here. And the particular thing that I'd like to point out in this verse is how the Brahmajyoti is the destination for those who aspire for liberation from the material world. So many, you know, we hear, in Prabhupada's books, we hear all the time about these three levels of realization: the Brahman realization, the Paramatma realization, and the Bhagavan realization. So Brahman realization is realization of the indestructible, eternal, all-pervading aspect of the Absolute Truth. And those who come to this level of realization and who think that this is the goal, they end up in the Brahmajyoti. And Paramatma realization is where you realize God in everybody's heart, and Bhagavan realization is the full realization of the Absolute Truth, where one realizes the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Krishna. So, somebody who accepts Brahman realization to be the supreme, like the ultimate goal, they might have a problem with this analysis that Prabhupada gives, that how Brahmajyoti is not the ultimate level of realization, but rather Bhagavan realization is. So, a yogi might have a problem with this. He might argue, well, no, Brahman is actually the ultimate. Is the ultimate level of realization, not Bhagavan. And he might use as evidence his own personal experience or the personal experience of other yogis who have attained Brahman realization. They'll say, well, you know, and they'll claim that, you know, well, we have superior power to see what actually exists in the universe and what is in reality. And because of that, you should accept what our version of reality is, because we have superior power to see. After all, they've been there and they've seen it. So therefore, Brahman is the ultimate reality. Of course, so devotees, they can argue back, they can challenge this claim, and they can say, well, perfection of, in the Srimad Bhagavatam, in the third canto, it says that the perfection of self-realization cannot be obtained by a yogi unless he engages in devotional service. This is a verse there in the Bhagavatam. But even to that, the yogi might say, well, okay, devotional service is good. It's a good path to help you get to a higher level. But ultimately, when you come to that higher level, you don't need to do devotional service anymore. It's just a good path to get you to the higher level. That's all devotional service is good for. So what could we say to that argument if someone were to present this to us? There are people like this that present this argument. Well, we can point out that that's actually a paradox. That doesn't make sense. Because you can't just use devotional service to get to some other end other than service to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Because if you think that the object of devotion is ultimately just to, it's like an intermediate level, and it's just meant to get you to a higher level, then it's not actually devotion. It's like having a friend who wants to get something out of you. I don't know, maybe some of us have had this experience of knowing people, having friendly relations with somebody, but ultimately they just wanted to get something out of you. So they'll be friendly to you, they'll be devoted, but as soon as they get that thing out of you, then you get the boot in the face. It's like the friendship is over, they stop caring. So that's not devotion, that's not friendship. So we can say that you can't just use devotional service to get to something else. It doesn't make sense. So the yogi might say, okay, well, maybe not devotional service, but still, Brahman is the ultimate. You still haven't convinced me that Krishna is the ultimate, because I could even prove, you know, put forward a logical argument for why Brahman is the ultimate. And I might use the philosophy of neti neti. So in 1880, it's a philosophy of negation. They try to distinguish between matter and spirit by taking away all of the material qualities of something, and then whatever's left, that's something spiritual. That's something purely spiritual. So they'll say all forms, all varieties and differentiation that we see, it's all material. So therefore, something spiritual has to be that which does not have any variety and does not have any differentiation. And this is Brahman. This is the ultimate reality. And this idea is also there in the Western philosophy. It's called via negativa or something. So what could we say to that? How are we supposed to challenge this line of thought? Well, we can easily challenge it. We can easily challenge it by asking simple questions. We can say, can something with that does not have variety produce something with variety? Is that possible? Or can something without qualities produce something with qualities? Or something impersonal, could it produce something personal? And we see with our practical experience that we don't see that. That's not how it works. For example, like there's, you know, it's described that matter just doesn't organize itself. We don't have experience of matter just coming together and organizing itself. Rather, we see that when matter is in an organized state, over time it progressively disintegrates and it goes into a less organized state. So, you know, humans are like considered intelligent beings. They're made of matter. And they can shape matter into different complex shapes and useful objects like a microphone or something. So, but one can ask the question, well, where did human beings come from? So one explanation is that they came from atoms that were just moving around, and they happened to come together in a certain configuration to form something which kind of resembled a living cell. And then that living cell somehow divided and created multiple cells, which started to act like more like a complex machine. And then by chance, through different courses of events, this organism changed over time, and it, you know, different changes occurred, and it eventually evolved into human beings or something. That's one explanation. This explanation, and the idea is here that it's all unguided, that there's no intelligence behind this mechanism of matter coming into being human beings. It's just all by chance. There's no guidance, there's no control, it just all happened by chance. And another way to say that it happened by chance is to say that there's really no cause behind it. Chance means that which doesn't have a cause. So we can say that something is superior to something else if it is the cause of the lesser manifestation. So with the example of like a microphone or something, humans created the microphone. You know, the microphone is a complex thing based on certain principles, and it was created by humans who understood these things. You know, first, before the microphone existed physically, it existed in somebody's mind in the form of ideas. And all the details and principles and all the understanding of the microphone was there. So since humans were the cause of the microphone, they're considered to be superior to the microphone. Just a simple argument there. And then you can also say something about, you can also use the example, like recently IBM, a number of years ago, they made this chess-playing computer. You know, they increased the value of their stock by building this computer that can beat the world's chess champion in chess. So one might say, well, look, the computer is superior to the human being because it can beat the best human being in chess. What is exactly inside that computer, one can ask. Well, there's a lot inside that computer. You know, it took many engineers, many years, working very long hours and at great expense, you know, using the best computer technology and computational skills and the deepest knowledge of chess that they put inside this computer so that this computer could then beat the world's chess champion. So one can ask, can you make a chess-playing computer that has no variety and has no differentiation, where all the parts are the same as every other part? There's no distinction between the parts. Can a computer like that beat the world's chess champion? Obviously, no, I don't think a computer like that. Now, within our experience, we can't imagine a computer like that actually beating the chess champion. So we can see how this idea of something coming from nothing, or some, you know, variety coming out of something with no variety, doesn't make sense. It doesn't work so well. So the idea of Krishna, who's full of variety, full of opulences and everything, coming out of Brahman, which is supposed to be not having any variety or differentiation, it doesn't make sense. So how can Brahman be the ultimate? Rather, the Vedic explanation is a little more satisfying. They say that you start with the most complex, the most sophisticated entity, and then that entity is the cause of everything else. So that entity creates lesser manifestations, expansions, or whatever coming from it, and all the complexity and sophistication in the lesser manifestations are there within the ultimate cause, namely Krishna. So that's how we can approach it, the person who argues along these lines. So then one person, so someone can still say, okay, that's fine, but we still see in the Srimad Bhagavatam that Brahman is a reality. Because we talk about Brahman realization, Paramatma realization, and Bhagavan realization. So Brahman is still there. This undifferentiated Brahman is still a reality. So what can we say about that? Well, we could say that this undifferentiated Brahman that you speak of, it doesn't actually exist. It's the Brahman of the philosophers. Because the Brahman that actually exists is differentiated. It is variegated. So to help understand how this can be the case, I have some images I want to show you. There's this nice analogy. Of the transmission of a television show. So the idea here is that there's a TV show in some TV station in some far off place, and somehow that TV show gets to all the individual TVs that are around, like the city, for example. So how this works is that at the TV station there's a transmitter, and this transmitter, it energizes the sky or the field, and we call it the energized field, and it creates different vibrational patterns that can propagate through the sky. And then in each individual home, there is a TV which has a receiver. And if this receiver is energized to a particular region, it's able to pick up on the signal from the TV station transmitter, and therefore you're able to see shows on your TV. Now, we can't see this energized field that's between the transmitter and the TV, but it's there. So from our perspective, it looks like this undifferentiated thing, but actually it serves as like the via medium through which the TV station can be or the TV show can be transmitted from the transmitter to the TV receiver. So one can ask a question, a very interesting question, which might not be so obvious, is that could the receiver, could a TV be created from the energized field? So could like a TV come out of this energized field, like a sky or something? So in order to explore if this is a possibility, the answer in theory that it is possible in theory, surprisingly, it is possible, but engineers are not able to do it. And in order to understand how, we can look at holograms. So everyone know what a hologram is? It's like a 3D image that's floating in space. And reasonably good holograms are rather impressive. You know, you can see like a hologram of the car, for example, in different angles and get a good idea of what the image is. So it doesn't have much substance, it's just made out of light, so you can put your hand through it and everything, but still, it's an object that can be created. So how holograms work is that you have light, which is a wave, or like a pattern of energy, and this light passes through a transparent, transparent or some kind of medium, which has a microscopic pattern on it. And this microscopic pattern can change the vibrational patterns of the light wave. And then this light wave can interact with other light waves, and it can create different vibrational patterns. And these patterns interact with the space on the other side of the transparent medium, and it can create different shapes and images and pretty much anything. And it can create like a 3D image of it. And this is all done on the principle of the interference of light. So we can take this a step further, and we could say, well, we can learn from modern physics that matter is also a wave phenomenon. you know, just as light is fundamentally made of waves, and it's like a pattern of energy, similarly matter is also a wave phenomenon. And if we can somehow, you know, like electrons are waves, protons are waves, everything that makes up matter is a wave. So if we can somehow have interference of matter, you know, with interference of light, we're able to produce 3D images in space. So if we can somehow have interference of matter, then we can make a what's called a matter hologram. And, you know, so you can actually create something, not just a 3D image, but an actual 3D object. Of course, in order to be able to do this, there's one major obstacle that we're not able to do this right now. And that's because the frequency of matter waves is very, very high. The frequency of light waves is relatively low, so we're able to manipulate it and make different shapes out of light. And these transparent mediums, they're made of matter, which is at a higher frequency. So matter, because it's at a higher frequency, it's able to focus the light energy and make light patterns on the other side of the medium. So if we're going to try to use matter to focus matter so that we can make a matter hologram, it's not going to work, because in order to focus matter, we need to have something that's finer than matter to be able to do it. Because you can't focus matter with matter. The frequency is too high. So this is the problem that we face in making a matter hologram. So is there something that's finer than matter? That's the question. Okay, so here's the matter hologram. The world is just supposed to depict the like a material thing. So the answer is yes, there is something that's finer than matter, and that's Bhagavan. So the idea is that Brahman is energized with information. And, you know, this information creates a pattern, and that pattern is the material universe as we see it. It's the world, or everything. So the world is kind of like, or the material universe is kind of like a matter hologram, which is produced by this energized field of Brahman. And Brahman is energized by a transmitter, and that transmitter is Bhagavan, Krishna. So we can come to the conclusion that, you know, we asked if we can make a TV out of an energized field, or a receiver out of an energized field, and theoretically, or at least we can see here, that the receiver could be generated from this energized field, but there has to be a transmitter somewhere in the background. That transmitter is Bhagavan. So this is kind of how it can work, at least in. So the idea is that Bhagavan is what makes for the variegatedness in Brahman. So Brahman's not this undifferentiated thing. It has variety and it has variegatedness, but that's coming from Bhagavan. So from like when Arjuna was seeing this endless light, the Brahmajyoti, from his perspective, it just looked like this really bright light, an undifferentiated thing. But we can understand from another perspective that there's actually variety there. And even in one perspective, we can understand that in the Brahmajyoti, there are innumerable souls, and each soul is an individual living entity. So in that sense, also the Brahmajyoti is considered to be variegated. It's not undifferentiated without variety. So this is what I thought I would share on this verse. There wasn't much to go on, so I thought I'd just focus in on this aspect of Brahman and the Brahmajyoti. So is there anything anybody would like to add to this discussion? I didn't come up with this. Sataputta came up with this analogy. He used this to describe Brahman, Bhagavan, and the material world. That was a very good analogy, so I tried to understand it and show it. Yeah. Yeah. Body. That might be a one filter that it goes. So his question was that maybe in order to create this the physical body that we have, the you know, I was describing how light goes through filters to create holograms. So he was saying, well, maybe Brahman goes through the filters of the mind and the intelligence in order to create like the body. And he was wondering if that makes sense, considering this analogy. Is that correct? Okay, so yeah, everything is Brahman, and it's only due to our material conditioning that we think of by the mind, intelligence, and false ego. This idea is referring to, so Brahman is the, everything is Brahman, so in one sense, so it's spirit. Everything comes from spirit. And the idea here is that in order for that spirit to create something like material, it has to go through Bhagavan. Bhagavan's the source of both spiritual and material worlds. So that Brahman has to be energized or transformed or put into variety by someone who has variety, someone who has complexity, who has personality. So that's Bhagavan. Bhagavan transforms that seemingly undifferentiated spiritual thing into something which has variety in material worlds, minds, intelligence, whatever. Is Bhagavan as being the source of the variety and the variegatedness. Is that okay? Okay. Anything else? Okay, sorry for such a technical class. What's that? Yeah, I can send this to you if you want. You have something in your initial moment? Well, everything is Brahman, so the idea is everything is energy of Krishna. So Brahman is considered like the energy of Krishna, so everything is the energy of Krishna, everything is Brahman. There's the material energy and there's the spiritual energy. And in fact, even material energy is considered to be spiritual. We think of it as material because of our contaminated consciousness. But actually, it's also considered to be kind of, in one sense, spiritual. Don't ask me how to explain that. Because from our perspective, there's like a very clear difference between something material and spiritual. Well, maybe not, but at least... So that's as probably as far as I can understand that topic without getting into speculation. So, you have something to add?
Three principal energies that Prabhupada discusses: the inferior, superior, and marginal potencies.
Mm-hmm.
And the tendency of the marginal potency, us, the jiva, is to take the inferior energy as superior, and thereby making it material. But it's still, although its matter is considered inferior due to its lack of consciousness, it's still spiritual because its source is Krishna. Mm-hmm. And so nothing can be outside of the purview of Krishna, otherwise he's not Krishna.
Sure, and therefore even the inferior thing is also Brahman in that sense.
Exactly, it's all coming from Brahman.
Mm-hmm.
In chapter 4 text, what's the text where the offering, the one who offers the consummation, everything is absolute, and one whose life is dedicated fully to spiritual activities attains the ultimate result at the end of his life? In that purport, it's for like between text 28 and 36, I can't remember. In that purport, Prabhupada elaborately explains this paradox. And it's all due to our own consciousness, that our own conditioning, that we don't understand and experience everything to be spiritual.
Very nice. Thanks for sharing. Yeah, Karuna Nidhi Prabhu. He's behind you.
Hare Krishna Prabhu. Can you please explain again what was you telling about frequency of the matter? Frequency of the matter.
So light is a wave, it's, at least according to modern physics, light is considered to be a wave phenomenon. It's like a vibrational energy, you know. So there's these mathematical equations which describe light as a wave. So it's just a type of energy that has a pattern, like a wave pattern. And a frequency means the...
Yeah, I know that. Yeah,
okay.
Well, my question is, the particles... They have the vibration, the like wavelength, you know, so that is actually frequency is equal to 1 by in reverse of.
Right, that's the physics definition, yeah, of a frequency.
So
yeah.
The question is coming, when the source, from the source, the light is transmitted, you know,
okay,
then it's telling about the reflection, but what's about when refraction, when it will be diverted from the original source?
I'm sorry, I couldn't understand. Could you repeat that?
Like, suppose, you know, when the matter particles are being highly frequented,
matter waves.
Yes.
Talking about matter waves having high frequency.
Yeah, so...
Yes, like electrons and protons and things.
Right, and yeah. What will be about refraction, means the effect of refraction?
Reflection?
Refraction.
Refraction.
Yeah. What will be the effect of refraction?
What is the effect of refraction?
Yeah, that means...
What do you mean by refraction?
Yeah, suppose, for example, when light transmits from one medium to another,
okay,
know, that time it doesn't go straight.
It changes.
It changes
from one pattern to another pattern after passing through.
That's called refraction.
That's right, okay.
Yeah, so what will be the effect of that refraction? That's what I was thinking.
If matter goes through some medium?
Yes, right.
So the matter wave goes through some medium, and what's the outcome of it? Well, the idea is that it would be Brahma. It wouldn't actually be... It'd be like an undifferentiated state of matter. You know, like light is considered to... You know, like white light, it's considered to have like all the frequencies and wavelengths there. So it's kind of like this undifferentiated light. And when it passes through a transparent medium, it comes out on the other side as something that's more specific and defined. So similarly, matter can exist in like an undifferentiated state, where it's not like looking like matter, but it has like the matter waves kind of in like this undifferentiated state. And when it passes, if it passes through some kind of medium which is finer than matter, then it can transform into like actual physical substance. Just like light can transform into images, similarly, undifferentiated matter can transform into solid objects. That's how this analogy would work. Of course, ultimately what's happening, though, is Brahman is spirit and is energy of Krishna,
right,
and Bhagavan is the transparent medium which turns that energy into something, you know, either material or spiritual or something.
Thank you.
Sorry, it's an analogy, so get it perfect with what's actually existing.
Can you please, where you are showing that reflection out?
This.
Oh, yeah, this one.
Sorry, for us who have gone through physics and physics classes in college, this is what we learn. For those who haven't, this is what you can learn if you go.
But in the middle of that.
Uh-huh. And there's a certain microscopic pattern in one medium, it transforms the light into some pattern, and then that pattern can go through another medium which will transform the light into a third pattern, and like that until you get to the shape and size and that you want. And then it'll interact with the space on the other side and create a 3D. I mean, there's lots of details to it, but that's the general idea.
That's good. Thank you.
Okay. Anything else?
I was appreciating this sharing now. In that pastime, you mentioned that Krishna and Arjuna, they go and they see Mahavishnu and Mahavishnu. And then you mentioned, I think, that Mahavishnu says, well, I'm glad to see my expansions.
Mm-hmm.
Now we know from the Tattva's expansion of Krishna. So yeah. Perhaps elaborate on that point you mentioned.
That's how it was described in the Bhagavatam, that Mahavishnu says, I just wanted to see my expansions of Narayana. But, and even Krishna, when he went to go see Mahavishnu, he offered his obeisances to Mahavishnu. So, wow, that's interesting, because we understand that Krishna is the source of Mahavishnu, not the other way around. So why is Krishna offering his obeisances to Mahavishnu? So I think it was described that Krishna is just showing us how we should to Mahavishnu. He's showing us how we can offer proper respects to the Lord. You know, even Krishna, even in his pastimes in Dvarka, he did all the household duties that any householder might do. He doesn't have to do anything. He's, you know, things can just get done just by his will. He doesn't have to do anything. But he performs all these, even like ritualistic ceremonies, and does all these household duties just to show us, to teach us how, what we should actually be doing. So similarly, when Krishna and Arjuna went to go see Mahavishnu, he was showing how that, that's my understanding. Now, I don't know so much about Mahavishnu saying that you are my expansions.
Now, sometimes we hear that the incarnations of Krishna, the avatars, come through, that Vishnu sometimes comes through the doorway.
Yeah, so I like that.
Can you explain that
too? Yeah.
Can you explain that point? Which
Vishnu? Yeah, so Krishna comes through, the medium through which Krishna appears in this world is as a avatar, as an incarnation of Vishnu. That's the medium through which he, so in one sense he can be, in that sense he can be considered like an incarnation of Vishnu, or an expansion of Vishnu. But really we understand that Krishna is actually the source of Vishnu. But Krishna appears Vishnu, something like that. Is there a correction? I could have a...
Which Vishnu?
I heard one devotee say it in an analogy that a square is a rectangle, but a rectangle is not a square. So Krishna is an avatar of Vishnu, but Vishnu is not Krishna.
That's a good way to describe it too.
Through my internal potency, I appear. So ultimately, it's coming from his internal energy. And I think it's... I think it's Siradakshayi Vishnu that actually... Well, no, I don't want to say... That's the other... Krishna, I'm not sure. Krishna Tattva is... Because it's... And the last Krishna that was here, that was Krishna Krishna, according to Prabhupada. Chaitanya that most recently appeared, that's not an expansion, which sometimes happens.
Right.
So all the more fortunate we are, that's my understanding, is that actually from Golok, actually from also Golok came Lord Chaitanya 500 years ago. To
just an avatar.
Expansions of... So because they're scheduled to come, sometimes expansions of Krishna as Krishna come to the different universes and planets, appearing millennium after millennium on time. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but it's not Krishna himself. So these other yugas, or other times that Lord Chaitanya appears in the material world, that's not Krishna himself. It's some avatar of Vishnu. And the other Krishnas that come, I'm not
also
sure. Well, Krishna comes once in a day of Brahma, I think. And then Lord Chaitanya comes as Krishna himself shortly thereafter. So that is actually Krishna, that's actually Lord Chaitanya. But the other yuga cycles, Lord Chaitanya appears. I don't know about Krishna. If Krishna is like, maybe Gokulananda might be able to... If the other Krishnas that come are avatars of Vishnu, or if they're actually Krishna himself. Okay, so he's saying from Kshiradakshaya Vishnu come all the other avatars.
So Rama went to pray to Kshiradakshaya Vishnu, and then he explained that he will appear as Krishna. But we know from the Acharya that in Srimad Bhagavatam explained that Krishna is two Bhagavan Swayam in the third chapter. So that's our evidence that Krishna is the origin of all incarnations. But that pastime, in the Krishna book, I know that Hridayananda Maharaj gives some explanations in the Srimad Bhagavatam. I can't recall them. So we can go there.
Yeah, maybe we can look it up. We'll see what other yuga cycles, like what are the different avatars of Vishnu that appear.
Yeah, every Vishnu appears, but only once in a day of Brahma.
Right, but there's all these other yugas that are...
in other yugas is not the original Krishna.
Okay.
Only once in a day of Brahma
is the original
comes the original Krishna, and there is a conjunction of yugas that in order to when it's coming Dwapara and Treta Yuga, comes Dwapara Yuga. And then after comes Kali Yuga, and Lord Chaitanya appears. The Lord Chaitanya, who is not different from Krishna Swayam, so from the original Krishna.
As far as this argument goes, I missed the first point of, but basically your premise was, okay, let's say someone thinks Brahman is the source, and then you mentioned these different, well, actually that's not logical, and then you took it from there. So how would you suggest, I mean, this example given by Sadhguru, this is like a very logical argument, but how does that relate to presenting like a Shastric argument?
There's lots of Shastra to say that Krishna is the source. You know, he's like 14:27 of the Bhagavad Gita says Krishna's, that the Brahman rests on Krishna.
So would you say that based on the circumstance, you might present either a Shastric or logical
example? Well, when I was presenting it, the yogi was presenting a logical argument using neti neti. The ultimate is Brahman because if you get rid of all the material qualities, you're left with the essence, you know, of something spiritual. So that was kind of like a logical way of presenting how Brahman is the ultimate. But then in my presentation I used argument back, saying, well, can, or without variety, produce something with variety, which is a logical argument. Is that, you know, he was using moral arguments to convince Krishna to fight the war because Arjuna was putting forward moral arguments.
Yeah, I think it's a very strong argument. I was wondering if anyone has ideas of how that argument could be defeated, if anyone has any.
This argument. Well, there's books and books written by modern scientists about how something can come from nothing. And it's a really serious subject. And there's a big debate whether something can actually come from nothing or not in the scientific community. You know, very smart people, you know, materially intelligent people, they are putting forward this lot of work and energy into these. I haven't studied or understood it, but I know that there's actually perhaps believes that something can come from nothing. That in the beginning there was nothing, and then they have a very elaborate explanation and word jugglery and flowery language, and they can somehow have something coming from nothing. I don't know. I'm sure Madhavendra Puri can go into all the details if you were here, but there is a legitimate school of thought out there, or at least a school of thought, which can give you the argument that you're looking for. Yeah. Right, peer-reviewed scientific journals where you can get your argument.
Does anyone else have any ideas how this idea could be defeated? Dishan? What do you think? Do you buy it? Do you accept the idea?
You You don't have to say anything, Sean, if you don't want to.
I was wondering before in your presentation, you were saying there needed to be something that was finer than matter.
Right.
And that was Bhagavan.
Mm-hmm.
But I wonder also how that finer aspect could not also be Brahman.
Well, just like you can't transform, you can't use, like I was saying, because you need to have something matter in order to make a matter hologram, at least according to this analogy. You know, just like in order to make a hologram, you have to have something finer than light in order to transform light into a hologram. And that something finer is matter, because matter is at a higher frequency. So similarly, if you're trying to make a matter hologram, you need to have something finer than matter in order to be able to focus that matter wave, those matter waves into a 3D object. So you need something finer than matter. So similarly, you need something finer than Brahman, which is Bhagavan, which is, you know, and when you get into this kind of realm, it gets a little hard to understand, but you need something finer than Brahman in order to be able to focus Brahman into something like matter, material universes or something. That's how the analogy was put. Okay, now it's the really last comment. It's 8:30, so this is, you know, ended here.
Yeah, just to support your statement, actually, when the particles become very finer, and that is called atomic stage, you know, in the atomic stage, there is in physics, modern physics, it is stated, there is a small quanta of energy is called photon. It's called photon.
Proton, yeah.
Yeah, photon, not proton, photon.
Proton.
P-H-O-T.
Oh, photon, okay.
Yeah, right. So that means to support your idea, I want to just add, you know, like maybe that quanta of energy from the original source of energy from Vishnu. It's Krishna. You can go back.
Okay. All right, so I guess we'll stop there. Thank you all very much. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.